Welcome, everybody. Wonderful to see you here in the flowchart space for a really particularly special program. I think everything we do is special, but I think today is really very, very special. For those who don't know me, I'm Jeffrey Leppendorf, Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation, where we explore poetry and the interrelationships of various art forms as guided by the legacy of John Ashbery. The Ashbery Resource Center is above me, and you're always welcome to come back and visit. And we do all sorts of programs online and here in the flowchart space. And if you're not on our mailing list and would like to be, there's a sign-up sheet up front. There are also copies for you to take, if you like, of Rain Taxi, the wonderful review of mostly small press books, to help yourself to one as you leave. And what you see to my right is a piano that we moved here from the house that John Ashbery and his partner David Carmani lived in for quite a number of years here in Hudson. So it's the Ashbery piano. You're going to hear all about it, so I'm not going to spoil anything. And you will hear played on it, as you know, when you got your tickets, not only some gorgeous music, but some music actually composed on this piano. You'll hear played on this piano. And I'll reveal one little thing that when Daniel was practicing a bit earlier, I think there were a couple little revelations about a couple of the pieces playing it on this piano, because I'll just admit to you, this is not a fine instrument. You're going to hear about how it came to be in the Ashbery house. Ashbery did not play piano himself, but he loved classical music a great, great deal. He loved buying sheet music to put on the piano, but not to actually play it. But many very famous pianists and composers have sat at this piano when it was in the house around the corner. So let me just tell you a little bit about the folks you're going to be hearing from. Daniel Baer, who will be performing in a moment, aside from being an active music educator, is a concert pianist who's performed around the United States. He also has served as the music director for the Queer Poem a Day podcast, which goes through Pride Month, hosted by the Deerfield Public Library. You'll hear me mention that again in a moment. He's also currently on the faculty of Illinois State University and the Music Institute of Chicago, where he also directs the Chamber Music Program. And now I will introduce Dylan Zavagno, his newlywed partner, like I can say. They're just back from their honeymoon. Is a writer and humanities educator and is the adult services coordinator at the Deerfield Public Library. And Dylan hosts the award-winning Conversations with Authors, Artists, and Academics on the Deerfield Public Library podcast and is also co-founder of the Queer Poem a Day podcast, which runs every June, of course, Pride Month here. And Dylan, along with Daniel, are here from Chicago. So welcome, Dylan Zavagno.
Hi, my name is Dylan Zavagno. It's an honor to be here and share this with you. What you're really here to do is watch and hear my husband, Daniel Baer, play a kind of homecoming on this piano. But before that, I'm going to tell you about how this all came about and then offer some thoughts on and readings of poems from John Ashbery's 1987 collection, April Galleons. And I'm going to say a little bit about the composer, Robert Savage. I'll talk for about 25 minutes. And I'm calling this, my title is a quote from April Galleons, "Unless children one day dig up the past in the attic." John Ashbery's April Galleons and composer Robert Savage. And I have two epigraphs for my speech. One is from John Ashbery's Norton Lectures, published as Other Traditions, from his essay on David Schubert, called "This is the Book That No One Knows." "For we believe in what survives. That which falls by the wayside, for whatever reason, cannot interest us." And then from a poem in April Galleon's Letters I Did or Did Not Get, quote, "There are too many of us ever to be remembered or recorded." At my job at the Deerfield Public Library in suburban Chicago, I host and produce a podcast called the Deerfield Public Library Podcast, in which I interview all sorts of authors from Chicagoland and around the world. And for 4 years, each June for Pride Month, the podcast transforms into a series called Queer Poem a Day. My co-founder and co-director of that project, the poet Lisa Heighton, and I invite LGBTQIA plus poets to send us a recording of themselves reading one of their poems, and then we package it as a daily podcast, highlighting and archiving some of our leading poets today. And each year we ask Daniel Baer to research and record a work for piano by a queer composer to accompany our Queer Poem a Day episodes. Other years have featured piano music by Samuel Barber, Carol Szymanowski, and this past June, Ethel Smythe. For our third year in 2023, Daniel chose Robert Savage's remarkable piece, AIDS Word Scherzo, which Savage wrote while being treated for complications from AIDS at the Lenox Hill Hospital in the last year of his life. Not much is publicly known about Robert Savage. He was born in 1951 in Saudi Arabia to American parents. He was a student of well-known composers Ned Roram and David Del Tredici. He died in 1993 at age 42. There really isn't that much out there about Robert Savage. There was a brief mention in The New Yorker of a 1994 tribute concert, a 1998 CD, An iSky Symphony, put together by friends, and a pioneering 2015 dissertation by the pianist Marcus Ostermiller titled Musical Responses to AIDS, Meaning and Signification, Two Works for Solo Piano by Robert Savage and Kevin Oldham. But Savage's sheet music isn't published anywhere. So Daniel went to the New York Public Library, Center for the Performing Arts, at Lincoln Center, Library for the Performing Arts, which houses the estate project for artists with AIDS containing the Robert Savage collection. So I get this text from Danny with a picture of a piece of sheet music, and it says, "Look in the upper left-hand corner." And it said, "For John Ashbery." Now, this was very exciting to me. Personally, John Ashbery is the poet for me. But we couldn't find anything about their possible connection. We just sort of wondered, was this an instance of a composer just being inspired by a poet, or was there something else? Eventually, I reached Jeffrey Leppendorf at the Flowchart Foundation, himself a pianist, who said, "That name Robert Savage is familiar, but the person to really ask is David Kermani, Ashbery's husband." I never would have in a million years thought we could just ask Ashbery's husband. So David Kermani wrote back these remarkable emails and confirmed that John and David, quote, were friends of Robert Savage, and that they probably met him through composer and diarist Ned Roram. David writes, We were good enough friends that as we were approaching our first summer in the Hudson House, 1979, we wanted to hire somebody to help at the house, mostly basic cleaning at that point. And Robert's living situations were usually unstable, so we offered him the chance to live and work there, but he insisted, understandably, on having a piano available. Exploring John Ashbery's Nest, which is a website and virtual tour of John and David's famed art-filled Hudson Victorian house, and clicking on the piano in the music room, we found an audio clip of Ashbery telling the same story, but without referring to Robert Savage by name. Ashbery said, quote, "When we first got the house, we weren't here very much. We had a friend of mine house-sitting for us, but we had to have a piano because he was a composer. So I got this very cheap piano from an ad in the Penny Saver." David Kermani, writing to us last summer, has a slightly different memory of how this all played out, telling us about the selection of the piano. Quote, "John and I agreed that we didn't want some cheap spinet, but one that would be a nice piece of furniture for the music room. We looked in all the local newspapers and Penny Saver-type tabloids for ads. I finally found a handwritten note tacked to a community bulletin board at our local ShopRite or Price Chopper grocery store. I called the number, discovered it was a baby grand instrument located in a house in the rural eastern part of the county, and went to see it. The owner's price was $500, which wasn't a small amount of money in those days, but we both liked it, and figured we probably wouldn't do any better than that, so bought it and arranged to have it delivered. Robert settled in, third floor bedroom, late spring, I suppose. John and I were there on some weekends when we weren't mooching off friends in the Hamptons. Things moved very slowly those first few years, but gradually came together, and the NYC and international cultural worlds became right at home in Hudson." Jeffrey Leppendorf and David Kermani were both thrilled to realize that this piano in the Flowchart Foundation space is, in fact, the same piano originally purchased for their friend Robert Savage. David Kermani told us that Savage, quote, "traveled a great deal and was hard to keep track of, and we pretty much lost contact with him during the last years of his life." He also tells us that he is pleased the story of their friendship and Savage, the lost dedicated compositions, and the history of the piano are now publicly coming to light. Quote, "John Ashbery believed that Robert Savage was a serious and very talented musicologist and composer. I know that John would be delighted that this is happening, as am I." All this can be seen as a story of the gay cultural networks in New York at a particular moment. It's also a story of how different generations of artists responded to the AIDS crisis. Savage was hired as their housekeeper in 1979 when he was around 28 years old. John would have been around 52. The first case of AIDS was reported in 1981. April Galleons, John Ashbery's 12th collection of poems, was published in 1987. The same year the activist group ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, was founded, and the same year President Reagan pledged to exclude safe sex information from federal educational materials about AIDS, and finally made his first major address on AIDS, in which he declined to mention gays or homosexuals. April Galleons is a book where death always intervenes. Many poems seem to refer to the dire and seemingly intractable situation as lives were cut short by stagnant political inaction. From the poem, "Never to Get It Really Right," "Nothing was performed that day, whether from civic malice, indifference, or just forgetting for a few moments something that should never be forgotten." Or in the second to last poem in the collection, the prose poem, "The Ice Storm," I'll read a longer section here. "To do that, though, get up and out from under the pile of required reading, such as obituary notices of the near great, he first gained employment as a schoolmaster in his native Northamptonshire. Of his legendary wit, no trace remains. is something that will go unthought of until another day. Sure, as we know that the government and the president want it. But we know just as surely that until the actual slippage occurs, the actual moment of uncertainty by two or more of the plates or tectons that comprise the Earth's crust, nobody is ever going to be moved to the point of action. You might as well call it a night, go to sleep under a bushel basket, for the probability of that moment occurring is next to nil. I mean, it will probably never happen, and if it does, chances are we won't be around to witness any of it. Poet and critic John Emil Vincent, in his 2007 book, John Ashbery and You, his later books, writes, April Galleons is not about living in the midst of the devastation of AIDS per se. Rather, it is more precise to say that it is about how one might go about living in that particular historical moment. The poet offers to himself and others the lyric medium as a site of survival. And by survival, I do not mean simply living through the period, but living in it as a rich subject, able to rage, mourn, worry, among all of the other things one does in living and dying generally. While it's always fraught to say exactly what an Ashbery poem is about, and certainly concerns over those, quote, barely tolerated living on the margin, to quote the famous opening of Soonest Mended, have long been a theme, April Galleons, I think it's fair to say, compared to earlier collections, is a little less humorous and a little more mournful. And though in quoting any excerpted section of an Ashbery poem for interpretation, someone might counter by pointing to the next incongruous, jarring line, the sudden shifts in mood in April Galleons are often between nasty and nostalgic, those being the performance directions that Robert Savage writes in the margins to tell us how to play the different jarring sections of his AIDS ward scherzo. Maybe these are just the shared practices of the late 20th century postmodern avant-garde in music and poetry. Or maybe, as Eileen Miles has said when discussing Ashbery, avant-garde was code for homosexual. Miles, in a 2007 piece on April Galleons, writes about these as poems of middle age and emerging from their era. Quote, the 80s, especially the late 80s, 1987 to be precise, the date of the publication of this book was the early height of the AIDS crisis. We all lost a million friends, my generation more than his. From the perspective of his age, the ones dying were largely kids. I wonder how that felt. Though he wouldn't be diagnosed until a year after this book's publication, Robert Savage's story at least names one of those kids that Ashbery was close with. I'm going to read the poem Vetiver, which is the opening poem of April Galleons. Vetiver is a plant you distill into oil for perfume. And this poem describes a communal loss and possibly what's left. Vetiver. Ages pass slowly like a load of hay. As the flowers recited their lines and pike stirred at the bottom of the pond, the pen was cool to the touch. The staircase swept upward through fragmented garlands, keeping the melancholy already distilled in letters of the alphabet. It would be time for winter now. Its spun sugar palaces and also lines of care at the mouth, pink smudges on the forehead and cheeks, the color once known as ashes of roses. How many snakes and lizards shed their skins for time to be passing on like this, sinking deeper in the sand as it wound toward the conclusion? It had all been working so well, and now, well, it just kind of came apart in the hand as a change is voiced, sharp as a fishhook in the throat, and decorative tears flowed past us into a basin called infinity. There was no charge for anything. The gates had been left open intentionally. Don't follow. You can have whatever it is. And in some room, someone examines his youth, finds it dry and hollow, porous to the touch. Oh, keep me with you, unless the outdoors embraces both of us, unites us, unless the bird catchers put away their twigs, the fishermen haul in their sleek empty nets, and others become part of the immense crowd around this bonfire. A situation that has come to mean us to us, and the crying in the leaves is saved, the last silver drops. Like in those last lines, the poems in this collection are full of references to a community, a we or us, barely surviving, afraid of facing and realizing all the gains they've lost. This is from the poem Riddle Me. We can survive the storms wearing us like rainbow hats, afraid to retrace steps to the past that was only recently ours, afraid of finding a party there. Oh, in all your life, were you ever teased like this and it became your mind? Or in a more direct way, in the poem Too Happy, Happy Tree, in the silent history, how we were going to be lovers when a climatic change occurred. Also in this collection appear direct references to the medical language of AIDS from Alone in the Lumber Business. It's safe around here, though. Something in the darkness understands, tries to make up for it all. But it's like a new disease, a resistant strain. Where were you when it was all happening? Night is full of kindred spirits now, voices, photos of loved ones, faces out of the newspaper, eager smiles blown like leaves before they become fungus. April Galleons is also a collection anticipating what it might be like for this disappearing world to be remembered, archived, misremembered, and forgotten. From the poem Unreleased Movie. And I mean, what shall be saved of us as we live aimed at some near but unattainable mark on the wall? Or, with some sadness and a sense of belatedness and some irony, the elegiac poem to a single lost person titled A Mood of Quiet Beauty, which ends with the line, "Museums then became generous. They live in our breath." I have to do the teacher thing of holding the books up. It's ingrained in me, I'm sorry. Jess Cotton, in her recent book, John Ashbery, Critical Lives from 2023, sees the AIDS epidemic as challenging the, quote, seemingly apolitical stance of the New York School cohort, resulting in a new directness about gay life in April Galleons. Cotton notes that the poem Forgotten Sex, in particular, quote, articulates the feeling of seeing a neighborhood gentrified and the difficulty of mourning not only the loss of a group of friends and contemporaries, but the entire architecture of a community. The poem is one of Ashbery's most outspoken, or as outspoken as Ashbery gets, queer poems, which barely conceals its rage for lives collapsing around him, end quote. I would add that the poem also anticipates what it might be like nearly 40 years later for us to look back and misunderstand. Here's the poem, Forgotten Sex. They tore down the old movie palaces, ripped up streetcar tracks, widened avenues, lampposts, curbs with their trees vanished. They knew who came after. A story of departing hands and affairs that mostly went untold, unless someone who was there once visited the old neighborhood. And then they would tell about it, the space of an afternoon, how it happened in the afternoon, so that no record, no print of it could exist for the steep times to come. And sure enough, even as the story ended, its shadow vanished, a twice-told tale not to be told again, unless children one day dig up the past in the attic or under brush in the backyard, what's this? And you have to tell them. We'll have to tell them then that the enormous nature of things had a face once and feet like any human being, and one day broke out of the shell that had always been, changed its answers to lies, youthful ambition to a quirk of the past, a fancy of some antiquarian concern that this damaged day can never countenance if we want to live past the rope of noon, reach the bald summits by late afternoon. Surely we are protected. Surely someone thinks of us often enough to keep the stain from setting. Surely all of us are alike and know each other from earliest childhood, for better or for worse. Surely we eat breakfast each day and shit and put the kettle on the stove with much changing of the subject, much twisting the original premise back to the nature of the actual itch engulfing us now. And when we come back from an outing, expect to find the furniture magically rearranged to accommodate revised, smaller projects no one bothers to question, except polite puss in boots with what is, in effect, a new premise. Try this one. The dust shows less on these rather sad colors. The time to get started and gain time, however brief, over the neighbors quarreling into sunset, once you've convinced them you're not playing and therefore not cheating, when the princess comes to see you on some perfectly plausible pretext, you'll know the underground stream that has never stood still is the surface and the theater for all that is to come. Too bad the revisions will never be adopted. But how lucky for you now, the change of face. Good times follow bad. And the locket is still on the chain on a throat. The askers, the doers, fall into silent confusion as it comes time to stand up like a sheet of metal in the blast of sunrise. I will do this. I can do no more. I cannot think on the edge of a platform. But the abandonment by love is a de facto sign of something else coming along, something similar in its measuredness, sweetness of things late, a memory for particulars as lively as though they happened still, as indeed they do sometimes, though like the transparent bricks in a particular dream, they cannot always be seen. In the years after Savage stayed in the third floor bedroom in the Hudson House, he continued to live an itinerant life, often saving up money to spend months on hiking trips around the country. In a letter to his teacher, Ned Roram, in 1981, Savage wrote, "I live on the fringe and do my best. Composing is all that has mattered. I construct everything else, jobs, city relationships around it. And yet I'm not ambitious. I don't have that drive to get my music heard by lots of other people. When I've done a good job, I don't need their approval." I found two entries referencing Savage from the Nantucket Diaries of Ned Roram, 1973 to 1985. Ned Roram was famous for his diaries. In the 1984 section, Roram notes Savage as part of his flock at a three-week music festival. And then these two representative entries from 1985. Though entries are usually effusive, this entry says in full, 25 October, death of Bill Elliott of AIDS at only 41. And a few entries later, 12 November, Roram describes going to a concert and, quote, later, hot fudge sundae with S and Robert Savage. Robert Savage was diagnosed as HIV positive in 1988. The writer Larry Osgood, a friend of Ashbery's going back to their Harvard days in the late 40s, came to know and befriend Savage through his housekeeping gig. Osgood said in an interview about Savage, "Well, I guess you'd have to say he was secretive to a certain amount. I mean, I didn't know that he had AIDS until well after he actually had AIDS. I think I heard it from John Ashbery, quite frankly." Later, Savage would become a devoted practitioner of Zen Buddhism and would lead Buddhist meditation classes through the gay men's health crisis. His last composition is dated July 4th, 1993, 2 months before his death. Here's the title poem, the final poem from April Galleons. April Galleons. Something was burning. And besides, at the far end of the room, a discredited waltz was alive and reciting tales of the conquerors and their lilies. Is all of life thus a tepid housewarming? And where do the scraps of meaning come from? Obviously, it was time to be off in another direction, toward marshlands and cold, scrolled names of cities that sounded as though they existed, but never had. I could see the scow like a nail file pointed at the pleasures of the great open sea, that it would stop for me, that you and I should sample the disjointedness of a far from level deck, and then return someday through the torn orange veils of an early evening that will know our names only in a different pronunciation, and then, only then, might the profit-taking of spring arrive in due course, as one says, with the gesture of a bird taking off for some presumably better location, though not major, perhaps, in the sense that a winged guitar would be major if we had one. And all trees seemed to exist. Then there was a shorter day, with dank tapestries streaming initials of all the previous owners to warn us into silence and waiting. Would the mouse know us now? And if so, how far would propinquity admit discussion of the difference, crumb, or other less perceptible boon? It was all going to be scattered anyway. As far from one's wish as the root of the tree from the center of the earth from which it nonetheless issued in time to inform us of happy blossoms and tomorrow's festival of the vines. Just being under them sometimes makes you wonder how much you know, and then you wake up and you know, but not how much. In intervals in the twilight, notes from an untuned mandolin seem to coexist with their question and the no less urgent reply. Come to look at us, but not too near, or its familiarity will vanish in a thunderclap, and the beggar girl, string-haired and incomprehensibly weeping, will be all that is left of the golden age, our golden age, and no longer will the swarms issue forth at dawn to return in a rain of mild powder at night, removing us from our boring and unsatisfactory honesty with tales of colored cities, of how the mist built there, and what were the directions the lepers were taking to avoid these eyes, the old eyes of love. John Shopdaw tells us Ashbery's drafts have first rabble and then pariahs before landing on lepers in that second-to-last line. And John Emile Vincent wonders how we should read those last lines. Are the old eyes of love the staid old ways of loving we should avoid, or the ones we might look towards for care? Eileen Miles says that this ending is, quote, almost more than I can bear. And that word avoid, a piece you'll hear tonight is Robert Savage's Dance of Avoidance from 1992. The word dance, as I'm sure Ashbery and Savage would appreciate, is in the word avoidance, a void dance. This is, in a phrase from this collection, sometimes used to describe Ashbery's poetry as a whole, something close to music. A final fugitive thought. Might Ashbery have been thinking about his old housekeeper, Robert Savage, in the poem from April Galleons titled Savage Menace? David Kermani wrote to us, I'm expanding now, a quote I read earlier. Robert only stayed a few months. He didn't like the housework and wasn't very good at it. He lived up in the third floor bedroom. I think we knew somehow that he had dedicated a piece to J.A. He traveled a great deal and was hard to keep track of, and we pretty much lost contact with him during the last years of his life. The poem Savage Menace begins, "The castle was infested with rats. For weeks, no one had unpacked the laundry or dusted the rungs of the chairs." And the poem ends. And though you and I can never catch up with everything thoughtful that happens to us, we are bold to say, I like it. This is, after all, why I came here. If everybody was twins, we'd be no doubt happier, but all in all, it has only to be mentioned in the bibliography for one person to go on caring about what happens to him or her, to be as a child when the baker's truck arrives and somehow fracture a sequence out of these long trails of figures like collapsed bean vines in the precious dust that salutes us with yet another color. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Daniel Baer. I'm the pianist for the evening. I'm not going to talk for very much, but I'm hoping to situate some of Robert Savage's work within the history, within music history, to give a little bit of a sense of the evolution of his musical aesthetic and style as we go through a selection of his oeuvre. The first piece we're going to hear is from 1975. It's called Cowboy Nocturne. Robert Savage was studying at Columbia at the time, a school that was known for hiring and employing Milton Babbitt, who famously wrote a 1958 article entitled Who Cares If You Listen, which is really entitled Music as, or Composer as Specialist. The musical aesthetic taught at Columbia was one of high modernism, total serialism, very atonal, alienating, rational language, which was an outgrowth of the post-World War years. Robert Savage hated Columbia and studied with Jack Beeson, the one-tonal composer who was there at the time. In one of his early letters to Ned Roram, he wrote, "By keeping a constant current of dissonance moving through your harmony, you change the pain into pleasure, or rather, the pain remains but becomes beautiful. In my own imagination, I identify this with an encompassing view of the world in which pain is not only to be endured, but to be accepted as the condition for beauty." Cowboy Nocturne. The next two pieces are on the program, I believe, are from 1982. One of them is undated. The other is dated 1982. And these are the pieces that are dedicated to John Ashbery. When I went back to the New York Public Library this past June, in one of the other boxes, Chaconne, which is dedicated to John Ashbery, is in the first box, there was an untitled work with a Roman numeral 1. This was also dedicated to John Ashbery. This was especially exciting to me because in one of the versions of Chaconne is a Roman numeral 5, and it seemed at this time that Savage was interested in composing a dance suite. The two movements here are very different from one another. The first has no time signature whatsoever, so there's no set meter. You'll find that the measures are of different lengths. The Chaconne is in 9/8. It's a very regular time signature. It's also based on a pattern, a repeating harmonic rhythm and a rising bass line. Writing to Ned Roram in 1981, Savage says, "I feel now that I must use my God-given talent for the benefit of fellow sufferers on this planet. I want to make them happy and reassured, to thrill them, show them that in the end all is well, the pain as well as the pleasure, evil as well as good, strife as well as peace. All is necessary. It's part of the mechanism of things. It's how my music works, at least." I'm going to play the prelude, or what I think of as the prelude first, followed by the Chaconne. In the Chaconne, there's a sense of rising tension like a shepherd tone, a pitch that always goes up and never seems to arrive. Thank you. In our interview with Rye Cook the other week, I mentioned that Savage can sometimes be very difficult to hear and to listen to. And I think we're about to enter a really important part of Savage's output, which is his output post his diagnosis of HIV and AIDS, of HIV. In Marcus Hostermiller's dissertation, he writes about his interviews, saying that some people think of speaking about Savage's music as pre-AIDS and post-AIDS, or pre-diagnosis and post-diagnosis. And I think, and he quotes David Del Tredici, as saying, the quality of Savage's music improved as his health deteriorated. He was, quote, very focused then, had his own real voice. It's like he had to force his voice to emerge or nothing. I think in both of those pieces, the writing is very intense and very unceasing, and it's very awkward for the pianist. It's very uncomfortable. And I don't say this to pat myself on the back in any way, because I just heard what I said out loud. But it's to say that there's something unsettled and searching about it. Those pieces came from 1982. He had just undergone a two-year period in Louisiana with intense writer's block, intense creative stagnation or feeling of being stuck. When he was writing to his friend Pat O'Hara in 1991, he wrote, he being Savage, getting an HIV-positive diagnosis can certainly help clarify your life and what's important. It's a very effective way of getting rid of the procrastinating frame of mind. I think sometimes in the pieces that you'll hear, and you might notice this, or I don't know if it really comes across, but there's sometimes people put things into music or into writing and you find yourself so very much into them or in them. And I find one of the things that I noticed as I've been studying Robert Savage is how much his dark, sarcastic sense of humor and wryness can be found in my own life. The next two pieces on the program were both written in 1992. The first is Eight Ward Scherzo. I found this piece first. It's probably his most well-known work for piano. I found this piece when I was looking for a work to put on a program centered on grief and memorialization. As Dylan and I were driving to Thanksgiving, actually, in the first year of lockdown, or of the pandemic, I was reading about Carlos Chavez, and he was writing about the genocide of ancestral people in Mexico, and mentioning how there's no grief to talk about the loss of jokes and languages and musics that weren't written down. In a lot of ways, I think music coming from this time period, which was less easily put down than ours is, can serve as a sort of memorial. And this past summer when I went to the New York Public Library, I found in the sixth box, a list of rhythmic notations that had to be written down after 1989, because while there were examples of Caribbean folk music and Yorubu music, there was also things like Madonna's Like a Prayer, and house music, and my favorite, Coke Disco. In Dance of Avoidance, in the first movement, the left hand, almost throughout, plays the rhythm of that he wrote down as house music. I think both of these pieces draw from Savage's life and the struggles he was facing as he was looking at his own mortality. In Eight Ward Scherzo, you'll hear two distinct sections. You'll hear a savage, brutal, nasty, and these are all words that he put into the music section, filled with chords, pulsing rhythm, an unrelenting, similar to Chacon, musical texture, contrasted with a section called Nostalgic. Totally different. I won't even describe it. You'll hear it instantaneously. As the piece progresses, you'll hear these two different parts merge into one thing. This duality that we heard very early on in the first quote I read from 1974 is something that continues throughout his creative life. As a practicer of Zen Buddhism, it's likely he would have known Shunryu Suzuki's writings, including potentially this one, which I find helpful when I play and think about his music and his work. Suzuki writes, "Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, nor actual difficulty in our life." In his own writings from this time period, Savage is looking at his illness as, quote, a breakdown in the ability to distinguish the self from other. He also changed his view on himself as a pianist. Quote, acute bashfulness and acute laziness had kept me on the fringes of the New York arts politics scene. I was no networker, I'd long ago decided. In addition, I decided I was no pianist, so I couldn't perform the music myself. For some reason, in the nasty heart of Ango, a Buddhist retreat, I chose to throw these two assumptions out of the window. There are two things that I find in these pieces that are so radically different from the ones we just heard. The first is a comfort and insistence on silence. The second is a comfort in paring down what the music is doing to express what needs to be expressed. I will play Eightsward Scherzo first.
Thank you. Thank you.
the last piece on the program is a set by Robert Schumann. These are the last things that he composed and had an active hand in publishing. They're called Gesange der Freude, or Songs of the Dawn. And they're dedicated to Bettina von Arnim, a poetess, a German poetess and progressive in the 19th century. These were written about 4 months and published about a couple of days before he threw himself into a river and spent the rest of his life in a sanatorium called Antonisch. So without further ado, Gesange der Freude. Thank you.
Daniel Baer, Dylan Zavagno. Thank you both, and thank you all for joining us for this autumnal evening. How lovely. Hope to see you all again soon here or online, and thank you for being here. Good night.